Bonsoir à tous, bonjour à tous, applaudissements. C'est bon. Ça faisait pas très spontané, hein. Je suis en train de regarder parce qu'il y a encore des gens dehors qui aimeraient assister à cette leçon de cinéma qui est d'abord très exceptionnelle ici à Cannes. C'est la première fois que Alfonso Cuarón va faire cette leçon de cinéma. Toutes ces leçons de cinéma, d'ailleurs, pour la plupart, ont été faites par le critique français Michel Simon. Et quand on regarde la liste, il y a quand même eu quelque chose d'assez impressionnant, du saisissement d'une époque au fur et à mesure du passage des décennies, puisqu'on en franchit une autre cette année. Et tous les grands metteurs en scène, Milos Forman, à qui on pense, par exemple, était l'un des premiers à les inaugurer, ces leçons. Et tous les grands metteurs en scène sont venus, souvent, ça alternait entre les Américains et les Français. Clint Eastwood était là dimanche dernier pour répondre aux questions de Kenneth Turam. Mais on est très content d'avoir un Mexicain. Un Mexicain qui fait partie de cette extraordinaire génération de talents de cinéastes. Et vous savez qu'on a dans ce festival Guillermo del Toro, qui hier a fait une magnifique intervention lors de la soirée anniversaire. Alejandro González Iñárritu, qui fait une installation de réalité virtuelle, qui est sans doute la première installation de réalité virtuelle d'auteur, c'est-à-dire de poésie, de transgression, d'une narration très particulière. Tout le monde ne peut pas l'avoir, puisque c'est individuel, c'est un spectateur par spectateur. Après Cannes, elle ira à Milan, à Los Angeles et à Mexico, peut-être en France. C'est je pense, quelque chose qui est de l'ordre de ce que les premiers spectateurs ont ressenti lorsqu'ils ont vu le cinématographe en 1895. Là, on rentre dans un monde et dans la nuit mexicaine de façon très, 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 très extraordinaire. Donc, ces Mexicains sont là. Gael Garcia Bernal était là aussi. Diego Luna, Michel Franco qui a son film Au certain regard. Bref, il y a un cinéma mexicain qui est l'un des cinémas les plus forts, les plus émergents depuis maintenant une quinzaine d'années. Parmi ces nobles représentants, il y a Alfonso Cuarón, et qui était membre du jury il y a quelques années, qui, comme vous le savez, a gagné des Oscars pour Gravity. Mais vous allez voir, pour ceux qui l'ont découvert avec Gravity, qui est son film complètement américain, qui a une longue carrière. Et quand j'évoquais Diego Luna et Gael Garcia Bernal, vous vous souvenez tous de Y tu mamá también, qui a été déjà un premier choc dans le ciel mexicain et mondial. Pour lui donner la réplique, le critique français, critique de positif, critique à la radio, pas seulement critique, mais aussi écrivain, historien, grand érudit et grand fidèle du Festival de Cannes, que je suis heureux avec vous et chaleureusement, et là, spontanément, d'accueillir Michel Simon. Et il va venir ici en gravitation, en lévitation, sous vos applaudissements, sans doute aussi spontané. Non, la demoiselle qui a devant, c'est... Voilà. Je suis très, très, très heureux de l'accueillir en général au festival et de le savoir ici pour donner la réplique à Michel. Merci d'accueillir Alfonso Cuarón. Messieurs, soyez bons.
Thank you, Thierry. So the conversation will be in English. I think it's...
Désolé.
Could be in Spanish, but I don't speak Spanish.
Désolé.
But anyway, you are, in a way, an international director, because it's very interesting, your career, because you have the point of view of the developed country, the United States, and a country in this phase of development, which is Mexico. So it gives you two sides to the thing. So we are going to speak about it. But first of all, I would like to speak about your beginnings. I heard you had a camera at the age of 12, and you were born near the Churubusco studio, which is the famous studio where Buñuel and other people were shooting.
Well, if I may, I just preamble with something.
That what
say,
you want.
Yeah, just say I'm so thrilled to be here. So happy to be here in an event like this. and I'm so honored and touched to have been part of the 70-year festivities last night of the Cannes Film Festival in the presence of real, true masters. It was something really extraordinary. It was so beautiful. I was so touched and grateful to be part of and have been involved in this celebration. And we finished the celebration at the end of the dinner, the Mexican way, with mariachis and mezcal and tequila. So yeah, I think that we took over a little bit during the last night. And I realized something. I came to a realization. I'm not sure if Cannes really likes Mexican films. But they love how we party. that's for sure. But anyway, I'm so happy, so proud. And yes, it was not Churubusco Studios, but there was other studios very close to my house, and that they shot mostly commercials. And I would sneak into there, but when I sneak into them, the only thing that I learned is that I was not interested in those studios, but I learned that you could sneak into studios. And so I started sneaking into the Churubusco Studios.
But it's interesting to see the life of a director, how you did so many different things before making a first film. You were, you photographed some films, some short films. You were an editor even on the two Mexican films that we are going to talk about. Yeah. You were a screenwriter. So you developed a number of, and how did it gel together to become a director?
Look, I think that my journey is a journey that I would never recommend anybody as a pattern. No, because it's a journey, frankly, filled with insecurities. And that I admire so many of my peers and so many young filmmakers that they can start that career with such a confidence. Part of my insecurities, to be frank, were economic. I had a kid when I was 20, and so since probably I was 20, 19, cinema became my means for support. So I was living in a time in which the industry in Mexico was absolutely difficult. You know, it was very difficult for young generations to do anything. There's a lost generation before mine that they didn't do anything, except the two movies maybe. So the prospects were really were not good, and on top of that, cinema became the way of maintaining myself. So I consider myself a blue collar of cinema, in the sense that I started with the workers, you know, and always with my goal to become a director. I had a long career as a first assistant director. For instance,
I think you even worked with Ariel Dombal.
I worked
as an assistant.
As an assistant, yes. I was Ariel Dombal's assistant in a film he shot in Mexico. I was so happy to be her assistant.
Now she could learn from you.
I don't know. I was just staring. it was. And my life, unfortunately, my career for a big part that I'm now exercising that, is being connected with that, not only cinema as the thing I love in life and my vocation, but also as the only way that I learned early on of how to survive. So that's something that was a big chain and bolt that I carry through one part. Most of my career.
But before you studied cinema at the film school, you studied philosophy.
And parallel.
At the same time.
I didn't finish either. But yeah, it was a parallel situation.
But it's interesting because in this film school, you meet Emmanuel Lubezki, the great cameraman, DP, that has followed you except Harry Potter. I think he photographed
exactly.
all your films.
Exactly.
And he's an extraordinary yes. cameraman.
I think one of, in his own right, one of the most important filmmakers.
And day. After that, he worked with Tim Burton, with Terrence Malick, with Michael Mann.
With the Coen Brothers.
But,
yeah.
And we could talk about his work because we will see some excerpts where he really shot quite extraordinary camera movements and so on. But and you were also in school with Guillermo del Toro.
No, not in school.
Where did you meet
because
him?
Because Guillermo is from Guadalajara. And how I meet, because Guillermo is another blue collar of cinema. And we share a lot of insecurities and ball and chains. You know, and I think it's something that has bonded us from early in our lives. Early on, I was from a boom. I did 12 films as a boom operator, for instance, a microphone holder, you know? And Guillermo was an assistant makeup artist, and, you know, and I heard everybody talk about this genius of Guadalajara, you know? And because even if I was just a blue collar among the young generation of filmmakers, I was known as someone with possibility, you know? So when I started hearing about this weird guy from Guadalajara that was full of possibility, I got a little jealous, you know? And I didn't meet him for a long time until, all my friends worked with him, and they all just talk wonders and how weird he was. And it was not until I was doing a TV show in Mexico before I did my first film, that it was some sort of Twilight Zone, that Guillermo and I, we call it the Toilet Zone, because budgets and so on. And I did my first one, and you got you to write and direct and do everything. It was, you have all the freedom to you do little thing, you know? And I did it, you shot for 3 days, and I was so proud of the result. And it was loosely based on a Stephen King book, novel, short story. And then one day in the production office waiting for the producer in the waiting room, and there's this guy, this weird guy, just looking at me. And he had done one, I heard that Guillermo del Toro had done one of those. And it was this one awkward thing of two guys, like knowing who is the other guy, but like cautious. And he said, literally says, "You're Cuarón, eh?" I said, "Yeah, you're del Toro, eh?" Yeah. He says, "You did that thing that is, I says, yes. It's based upon Stephen King." And I was surprised that he knew the references. He says, yeah, how do you, I'm glad you found this. He says, and we started discussing Stephen King and how great that short story was. And then he takes a pause and says, "The short story is great, so why you short suck so much?" Yeah. And I was, what? You know, like, and he says, yes. And he started explaining me why, and he was absolutely right. And then we became best friends ever since.
So you were only three musketeers. There are four, but you were three. Iñárritu, De Toro, and you. Mm-hmm. Well, what was your relationship, your particular relationship to Mexican cinema, which has a great history, from Buñuel to Arturo Ripstein? So what was your relationship to your national cinema?
Look, I belong to a middle class in Mexico in a period in which the so-called golden period of cinema had passed. And then there was this spirit in the 60s, there was a young cinema that highly interesting stuff happened. And then it became a very stiff industry in which audiences in Mexico stopped watching Mexican cinema. I would, because I was a cinephile since young age, I could follow the whole thing. And I soon identified, like, it was so clear for me who was the generation who was the masters, the new masters. You know, there was Ripstein and there was Casals, you know, and that I remember one of the films that completely turned my life around was a Felipe Casals film called Canoa. That I think has been like a big mark in my life and the way that I approach things. My dream was to be able to assist them. And I have to say, I put myself in their services so many times, and I never had the opportunity to do so. Nevertheless, among that generation, there were very generous people as well. And those people also helped me. And I have to say, if I have to say, I sucked the teeth of that generation. I'm very grateful with that generation. Saying so, we were, when Chivo and I, we started, Lubezki's Chivo, we were struggling like hell to get rid of certain tendencies that we didn't like of that generation. Unfortunately, a lot of that got into, and I think unfortunately, into the technical aspect of it, and the visual and the polishness of it. And I think that in a way that distracted my journey, and I dare to say Chivo's journey, maybe 10 years. In the sense that for too long we were concerned about creating a form, a good form, something that looks like we used to see French cinema or American cinema that can look, and Mexican cinema used to look a little funky. So, and I think ultimately, if I see in retrospect, was a distraction.
So we will start with the first excerpt, which is your first film in 1990, 27 years ago, which is, of course, a Mexican film. You start with a Mexican film. It's the story, in fact, of a Mexican yuppie who is like inspired, maybe you were inspired by Don Juan, the story of Don Juan, a man who seduces all the women, and particularly a nurse who is being dumped by him, and she trucks, she does something about the test for AIDS, and he thinks he has AIDS. And we'll see a small excerpt, and I think it's very interesting because you see so many, it's quite different from your later films, there are so many details and a lot of editing. In a few minutes, in 5 minutes, you have maybe five or six different situations. How do you say solo con tu pareja in English?
The way they call it there, that in the Criterion Collection is called Love in the Time of Hysteria.
All right. I think we can look at it from
here. So
now, there is in 5 minutes, there is an amazing number of different situations and locale and so on. And even some surrealistic elements like this baby in celluloid or the piece of green paper that you see a short kind of influence of surrealism, I don't know. But the film is a sense of humor also, which is so. How did you? It's a film like really a first feature where you want to expand the language.
I guess that at that time my hero was Luis. So I always wanted to do, Luis and the school that Luis created. I was very intrigued by that. I was very intrigued by rhythm. But at the same time, I was very intrigued about the new forms of cinema. You know, Noel Bog has passed already, and Scorsese was doing, he had already done After Hours, in which, the convention was comedy has to be playing one shot. You know, comedy is to be playing one shot, and the actors do the joke, or you create the rhythm inside the frame, Howard Hawks and stuff. But then I was interested in how Scorsese approached comedy. And that was, and because Chivo and I we were in search of this technical language and stuff, I guess that was the product. But also, at the time in Mexico, there was all this stupid stuff about AIDS, in which it was all this homophobic approach of AIDS. It's a disease that doesn't happen for male, you know? That's only for women and for gays, you know, not for male heterosexuals. And actually, it was more for gay. It was more specific for gay. And then what we wanted is to do a comedy that was going to challenge all this, you know, all the macho attitude towards the whole thing, you know? And that was the point of departure. But at the same time, at that point, look, Chivo and I, when we used to do the toilet sauce,
Lubezki.
It's short Chivo. We always call it Chivo. With Chivo, and I were doing the toilet, the horas marcadas, those horror shows in TV. We were happy if we have done one shot that was a decent shot. We evolve in this film saying, if we do one scene that is a good scene, we're happy. So we were really low expectations in terms of who we were and that's the truth of the matter.
I thought more of Blake Edwards, you know, this kind of...
There was, because he's a heir of that whole thing, in a less formally and structurally less interesting. It's so funny how actually formally he was interesting early on, Days on Wines and Roses and all of that stuff. This, later on, it's more about rhythm and gag.
And also you have the breaking, you know, with the scenes with all the people, the older people with this little baby in celluloid, and so it's a completely different atmosphere. And also the way you shoot the main character with a wide angle when he's, you know, the Lubetzky is also with you trying to expand the visual aspect.
Look, at that time also, because we have just early years before Chivo and I, Lubetzky and I, we produced a film. A very small Mexican film, was the first film of a filmmaker called Luis Estrada. Well, we produced with him. And it was this thing in which it was the language of the long lens, because long lens look, everything look polished. You know, looks, you know, you take the short depth of field allows you to be look more vaporous, if you might. And I started reacting against that, and it's something that's been consistent ever since, the wide angles. I was in my still camera, I was experimenting with wide angles, so wide lenses. And this film, I remember, I haven't seen this thing ever since, but we shot different optics. My first three films, we shot different optics, and ever since then, I just shot two lenses.
And also, we are reminded that you were a student in philosophy because you start with a caption with the Newton law, and you have a kind of titles before the sequence.
And that's something that was already intrigued, because I was playing with stuff that I like in movies and stuff. I was intrigued with titles. The way that the Nouvelle Vague used to use titles, or even the way that Woody Allen uses titles, you know, to separate chapters sometimes. So in other words, it was a salad of stuff that I was intrigued about. I'm very grateful of every movie I ever done, but as I grow older, I start having a bigger awareness of when I start having, I'm a late bloomer in that sense, a bigger awareness of the cinema, like the cinema I always love.
But the film gave you a passport for Hollywood. I mean, I know that Hollywood knows how to seduce foreign directors, the best of them, to become Hollywood directors. But now after a first film, I think the American distributor hesitated to distribute it because you made fun of AIDS. You made a comedy with AIDS, which was supposed to be a very serious subject. Yeah. But nevertheless, you were invited to do The Little Princess in Hollywood. How did it come so quickly?
Well, it was one of those weird kinds. What happened is that this film premiered in the Toronto Film Festival in 91, I think. But even before arriving to Toronto, Miramax had bought the film, and the premiere was awesome, was amazing. And we were so happy because I was broke. I was broke, I was in debt. And there was Chivo, my brother and I, and my producer in Toronto. And that night, I decided to take my brother and Chivo to celebrate, and we full celebrate. And then my producer next day says, "Hey, I have this receipt." Says, "Yes, you know, I know, but we had to celebrate. You know, we sold the movie." Says, "No," they say, "it fell apart." And so I says, "Yes," but I thought I was rich. At that point, I thought I was rich. And what happened is the film didn't get an American release. Nevertheless, some people like the film, and they start showing it around to the producer's studio and stuff. Sidney Pollack saw it. He liked it. He called me. They flew me to LA. And in many ways, I have burned my ships in Mexico. I was not going to be able to finance another movie with the government at that point. I had burned my bridges there. So that was, again, it was not by design. It was where the job was. You know, I was anxious because I have debts, I have my kid, and I need to get some money, and suddenly they were offering me something over there. I went, and I was flattered and honored to meet Pollack. And somehow I discovered a tit, you know, that could support my immediate thing, because it's so weird, Hollywood. You can live all your life without shooting one single movie and support yourself as a director. It's so weird. You can be developing projects, you know, and projects that will never happen. And I entered the limbo. You know, I entered the limbo, but first Sidney, one more time, because one of his projects fell apart. And there were not projects that I was in love with. There were projects that I would say, okay, this is not offensive, I could do it, and, you know, and I can survive. But he invited me to do a series called Fallen Angels, in which Soderbergh was one of the directors, Jonathan Kaplan, Phil Joanud, who was super hot at that time in Hollywood, and Tom Hanks and Tom Cruise directed an episode as well. And Sidney posted me there, and I was the only unknown. So obviously I had, everybody shot like for 10 days, I had 5 days. Everybody had, you know, I was the ugly duckling, but happened to be the episode that won all the awards later on, you know, of the anthology. It was a noir anthology. And from then it happened that I read a little, I kept on developing in that limbo, and I was developing something at Warner's. Chivo had read the screenplay. I said, you should read the screenplay, it's great. I read the screenplay, I didn't even finish, and I called my agents and say, hey, I want to do this film. And I said, you can't do it because it's at Warner's. And it says, so you're already developing something, so it's very unlikely they will, you know. It says, well, then I quit to the other one. It says, yes, but if you quit to the other one, doesn't mean that they're going to give you this job. It says, yeah, I don't care, let's go. And it was the weirdest thing because the producer didn't like me. Nobody wanted me. I went to the meeting and nobody wanted me. The producer, the writer, they were so against me. And I walk out with the job. It was as weird as that. I walk out with the job with a producer and a writer hated me that then through the, very early in the process, we became all best friends, you know? But it was this thing that all the force were against, and the producer kept on fighting with the studios. Why you gave the job to this guy? Through the mess that for the studio was a small movie, they couldn't care less.
But there is something really paradoxical, is that your two Mexican films, Y Tu Mamá También and the one we have just seen, are rather realistic movies. They don't belong at all to magic realism, which is linked to South America, to Latin America, you know, with Carlos Fuentes, with García Márquez, with Vargas Llosa. They are more realistic, and it's in Hollywood that you make imaginary worlds and fantastic movies with Great Expectation. This film, The Little Princess, which I think for a long time was your favorite film, maybe since you made... Gravity, maybe today it's Gravity, but at a certain time you mentioned Little Princess as your favorite.
It is. I mean, once that I finish a film, I never see it again. Sometimes I have to do like some upgrade of, you know, format, and but it's no sound and out of order. And even like I cringe anyway, you know, watching the thing. Maybe the reason is all my friends, my peers, a lot of them, Alejandro, Guillermo, they talk, and they consider the films their babies that they nurture through their lives, and they love them and stuff. For me, it's more like ex-wives. You know? I love them so much. love them so much. I gave as much as I could. They gave me as much as they could. And we move on, and we love each other from the distance, you know? But I don't want to see them again. You know? It's a little
but
bit
so
like that.
The little princess, the sequence we are going to see, it's a little girl. Her father is sent to war in 1914, and she's sent to a school in New York. And the scene we have here is her arrival at this school, and she discovers the school mistress, the head of the school, and so on. It's very interesting because the next film we are going to see is your adaptation of Dickens, Great Expectations.
Do we have to go through that?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
No, but it's interesting because this is the adaptation we will see is in modern times. It's very far away from Dickens. And this is very Dickensian, this sequence.
Well, maybe one is a bit more successful than the other. What I mean is, look, in this film, it's something that like this was this search of form. And one of the things that we experimented in doing the TV show was color. And then I started doing TV shows that everything was green. The first film that you saw, maybe people didn't notice, but everything is green. All the sets, all the costumes, all everything is green. And same in this film. You know, it was like, there was this formal, and I guess it's just because it was a unity of color. I was, frankly, probably insecure about the other possibilities, or ignorant, maybe. But there were, in this film, there were certain, this film really, when I read it, I didn't have to finish it to say, this is the film I have to do. Had to do with, yes, this spiritual quest, in many ways. I was very in sync with what I was going through in life, but also, something that I think has been present in all the films for one way or the other, probably except Gravity, because it's different to find lower classes in Gravity, in outer space. It's only rich people going up there. But it's the class conflict, you know? And this was a perfect example. It's a story of a rich girl who befriends the servant of the school, and the rich girl becomes the servant. You know, and I'm just saying that because that's something that, yes, carry on in the other films. Formally, nothing except the faith and convictions that stories can be told visually. You know, and dialogue is a support for what's the cinematic experience that includes sound and so on. And also try to give inside the frame as much thematic information in the frame, not explicit, thematic and visual information.
But what is characteristic of your future style, and even in this film, is a sequence shot. That is to have the camera for a long time in one shot, and you have this in the corridors of the school, and it will go on with
and
all
And we
the...
did one, I see, if I remember correctly, we did one-shot deals, some one-shot deals insecurely. In all of my films, ever since my first one, I always had that kind of stuff. But we were aiming for those, but cautiously. Something that I have to say, it's the first film that, as opposed to the other film, that I learned something that is one of the amazing, fantastic gifts of process, of creative process, that is limitations. You know, I didn't do it in my first film, and in this one we start putting limitations. One is that everything was going to be experienced from the point of view of the girl, meaning that everything is not only that in each scene the girl is there, everything is seen from her point of view, meaning her over the shoulder. You never see any other character over the shoulder, you know? You can see them from the perspective of the other characters, but not over the shoulders. Every master, when the camera, the wide shot, when the character enters, is always from the point. You never see stuff that before the character sees it, you know? And I discovered it was frustrating, limitation and frustrating, because cancel cool possibilities. But the consistency of the limitation is when it starts to create an inner language or an inner, you know, like something consistent, formally consistent. So if something, there were silly limitations, if you might, but it was the first one, there were conscious limitations.
You, in this film, you started a collaboration with Richard Beggs for the sound. You spoke about the sound conception
yes.
of the film. And he will follow with you on The Children of Men and Great Expectations.
Yeah, yes, of course.
So what was his contribution? How did you work on the sound conception?
Well, when I one of the fun things that once that you are in the toy factory that Hollywood can be, is that my producer that who used to hate me and then he was cool with me, got, you know, really a great group of people, including the production designer Bob Welch, who had done all the Tim Burton early work, and he had collaborated with Beggs. So he asked me if I would be interested in meeting with him, and I was thrilled. I love his work. You know, lately he hasn't done much. He's done mostly Sofia Coppola films. He's very focused in what he does. And it was an amazing collaboration. It was just, I think he's an artist in his own right.
And the character of the head of the school, who is Eleanor Brown, she looks a little like in the next film, Great Expectations, Anne Bancroft, this kind of old woman, the way she walks down the stairs. And
I would say it's atypical, but doesn't look like my mom, but yeah, I don't know. yeah, probably. Look, if we are going to talk about the next one.
Yes, Great Expectations.
Let's go for it.
Which is really a very radical adaptation because it takes place in the modern time. You have again children because this film starts with the. We don't see any excerpt of that part, but it starts with two children, the two characters of Dickens, and then it moves to the arts world because he's a painter, not in the novel but in the film. He's a painter, and there is a portrayal of the scene of the artist and so on. So, how did you decide to change completely the time of the not the 19th century London but New York and the art world?
That is part of the problem, I think. The part of the problem is not that it's adapted nowadays, because I think that can be done wonderfully. No, the problem is that I didn't do it. The problem is it's a project that was offered to me, and it was over several times, and I always say no. And I allow myself to be seduced by the wrong reasons. You know, one very important is I was running out of money, and I had to find a job, you know, very soon. And then when I was in the point that okay, I have to get a job, that unfortunately, that's what happened. I have said no to that. He says, yes, but they're really insistent that they want to meet with you. And Art Linson, the producer, is a super charming guy. And he says, Art wants to fly you to New York to have dinner with Bob De Niro. What am I going to say? I'm not going to have dinner with Bob De Niro. I went to New York to have dinner with Bob De Niro. I could have leave it there. And says, nice to meet you. But then you just get seduced by it. It's seductive. And if you're stupid and you're a little, you know, and I was insecure about, I was convinced by the studios, and that's something so dangerous, that you develop things. You're a director. You don't write. I forgot I was a writer. You know, I forgot that I was anything else. I spent my days reading screenplays, you know, and then selecting someone and going out to shoot. So this was the choice that was given to, you know, the best choice that I got in that moment. And I have said no three times, and it's okay, let's go for it. And I became cocky. I said, well, the script, I don't like it, but we're going to compensate visually. Never. You know, when it's not the essence, the concept, the soul is already there, you cannot compensate with anything. And that's the truth of the matter. It's not nobody's fault but mine. It's not the studio, it's not the producers, it's not the actors, it's mine. I did the wrong film. I should have not done, I didn't know what I was doing. It was a horrible experience because, yes, I was doing pretty shots. Some stuff is absolutely beautiful, I'm talking about Chivo's work, not my work. The design is absolutely beautiful. One more time, green. but that's that. It is what it is, like that. You know, I was intrigued. Ultimately, I said, "Well, class is involved." Because in Dickens, the tale is a tale of class, ultimately.
But there is not the bitterness and the sadness of Dickens' original.
I didn't have the grip of the material. Also, there's another thing. Me as a Mexican, I didn't have this reverence towards Dickens. You know? I was stupid. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to inflict you a commentary on what I think is...
Oh, by the way, I'm grateful. And I got amazing collaborators. Francesco Clemente did the paintings for the film. He loves the film, says, please stop trashing the film, stop trashing the film. But I have to be honest in terms of my prose. We're in presence of, future filmmakers probably here and stuff. It's just, I blew it. Simple as that.
Well, I'm sorry, nevertheless, to inflict you a commentary because I will show you a very brilliant, I think, piece of cinema, which is in Great Expectations.
Okay.
It's with Ethan Hawke and Gwyneth Paltrow, and they are now adults. They were children. They loved each other as children. And you can comment also on these three films in a row where you deal with children, The Little Princess, and this one, and Harry Potter. Child actors, how you deal with them. But we'll see this sequence where he's looking for her, and you can see it, and Lubetzky sequence shot.
Well, thank you. If the whole thing was like this.
So I think then from now on you have to reconsider this film.
Yeah. I wish that was a film. No, look, I should be less tough on it. It's just that truth of the matter maybe has nothing to do with the film. I don't see the films after. It's more about the experience and the learnership. And I feel embarrassed about part of my process. You know, I feel embarrassed of... I didn't have the grasp of the material. I'm so grateful with this film, because if it's not because of this film, I would have not done my next film. And literally I was... because everything is so perfectly designed, colors and stuff. And one day, we're going to one location, and we're going through New Jersey in New York, and I'm just looking rooftops and stuff and say, Chivo, why the heck are we stylizing things? You know, what's happening? And he says, well, it's too late in this film, man.
but this incredible camera movement in this sequence, I mean, it's just, how many sequence shots there are, two or so?
In
what we saw, we just saw.
Oh, how many shots together? Maybe it's a couple of shots together.
True, yes.
Just because of you remember, it was 35. It was a different game now to be able to, because I wanted to extend the run more, and physically we didn't have more street. But all of this thing of the continuous shot, maybe it's, since my film school shorts, you know, I did one that the whole thing was a shot composed mostly with cuts, but everything leading to the climax and resolution that is a one-shot deal, you know? That the whole point is a one-shot deal, you know, of that. So from very early, I learned to love from obviously seeing Orson Welles and that kind of stuff, but I was exposed very early to Yangtze, you know, that I was very impressed by, it's a completely different thing, you know, because it's very abstract, but I start loving the possibilities, you know, and also watching. Actually, the important thing of this film is what happened after. That I really lost my track, and I wasn't just, okay, what's going to be my next project, and Hollywood, I'm going to read, and didn't do well commercially, so they don't send you that good of scripts. And I was in that kind of a limbo when I was completely disenchanted by the whole thing. And then I realized I was disenchanted not by cinema, but what I've been doing and the process and where I was. So I went to the video shop, there were still videos at the time, and I just went there and impulsively just started renting the films that I considered that made me fall in love with film in the first place. And I took, like, there were VHSs, like piles. Actually, they were very obsessed. You cannot take that many. I said, please, 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 I have to leave. Credit cards, whatever. I took them and I locked myself 1 week. And I was just in a diet of, and I realized I haven't watched these films. I have abandoned cinema. I have abandoned the stuff that I love. You know, and that's the moment that I decided to do it to Mamá también.
But talk a little about the music in that film, and also your view of music in films in general. How do you use it?
Well, it's very different. I think that I consider this film school what we're watching right now. You know, it's I was very lucky. I was blessed that we worked with Patrick Doyle, the composer. He's fantastic. He has so much fun, and he's so much fun. The first film, all the music was Mozart, Don Giovanni, because in many ways was based. The structure was, as you said, Don Giovanni was the Don Giovanni of Tirso de Molina. That is the one that Mozart took as a basis for his Don Giovanni. And the music was the Don Giovanni mostly, another Mozart music. The second one was, and the third was, were Patrick, in which the music was going to be a character, to be present, to be omnipresent all the time. And I enjoy the work of it. I watch it now and...
Look, the response.
I know, it's a fantastic response. It's beautiful, the music. Of course, you can play it and you will applaud. You know, my thing with that is the combination of everything for me now, what Italians will call troppo. Too much.
And so the next film is interesting, what you have just said about your Hollywood period, because you go back to Mexico and very different from...
By the way, I never live in Los Angeles.
No. But I mean, you come back from your artistic experience.
Sorry, Guillermo, I have to point it out.
But the film is really a kind of love letter to the Mexican landscape. It's a road movie, and you have these two, Diego Luna and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, not Marquez, Bernard, and Maribel Verdú, she's older than these two guys. They just met her. Her husband is cheating on her, and they go towards a seaside, to a beach. But they travel around Mexico, and it's like rediscovering your own, even if you lived in Mexico City, still. It's like you rediscovered the landscape after two films in Hollywood.
Yeah, no, it was definitely was... I had just to find myself again one more time. And I was lost, as I said before, I was lost between, first and foremost, the blue-collar aspect of it, of just the means to support. And also that Hollywood had convinced me that I was a hack, not a director for hire. I was not a writer. I was not something generating his own projects. And I believed it, but that's my fault. So that what happened after this is I had to find myself who I was. That's the reason of watching all those films. I was living, by the way, Mexico, ever since I did my first film, I never went back to live in Mexico. I live most of the time in New York at that time. And And I wanted to go back to my country and make a film there. Also, when I start watching all these films, I start getting very, very, very upset with myself. Because that's what I was supposed to be doing, not all of these other stupid things, you know? And they're not stupid, they're part of my process, and I'm grateful. And here's present someone that I think that in my life, career has been a big support in that period particularly, because he was going through similar struggles in Hollywood as Guillermo. You know, and also losing his way and trying to find his way in all of this. And again, I'm not saying that everybody does that journey, falls into that. It's just that I think that you have to arrive with more security than the one that Guillermo and I arrive as who we were as filmmakers, you know? And I immediately called my brother and said, hey, you remember that story ages ago that we talked about? Let's do it. He says, okay. And then he flew to New York and we wrote the screenplay like in 3 weeks.
So now we are going to see this on this long journey to the beach. They stopped in a little town, mm-hmm. and we have a scene with these two young guys, the Julie Jim. I don't know how you have Mexican names for Julie, yeah. Jim, uh-huh. and this woman, and they get together maybe first time they talk in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. So we see the sequence. You tell us about the place and mm-hmm. how you discovered this place and the journey that it was. Now, how was the location scouting, and how did you discover this place? And you have also this conversation between the three of them, but the beggar woman, the other woman who goes into the kitchen, and so on. These kind of details. Was it improvised partly, or was it all written exactly?
It was a combination of all of the above. The way we found the places is that Carlos and I, we wrote the even before we finished the screenplay, that we had the structure, that it was going to, in the search of this mythical beach that they never been. So we decided to take the route. And pretty much the route started informing one more time the screenplay. You know, and the social context started to inform the film and the characters. This one is a place that is a town that is 45 minutes from the capital of Oaxaca. It's a town that is constantly under siege because they have a big resistance against all these very corrupt movements of the government in Oaxaca. And, you know, like also authoritarian stuff happening in Oaxaca. And part of the idea, early on, Carlos and I were very, very clear that this was as much as a coming of age of Julio and Tenoch, the two characters, as also the coming of age of a country. And we started with Chivo to work. Again, this film, we started filling it with limitations. You know, limitations now saying, no dollies, no cranes, no nothing, handheld, wide angles, no other lenses, honoring the moment, but also in which to create the film language and experience in which character is as important as context, and each one informs the other. You know, so I think in that sense, it's just, I think it's two parallel stories that are being told with the same thematic.
The film is also about, for these two guys, is finding their identity, mm-hmm. which was the same problem with you, to find your identity.
It was absolutely the same issue going on, but also refining my country. Refine my sense in my own country. in a period in which my country was going into the biggest transformations in the recent history, that is the transformation for the first elections, the first, you know, to become a democracy that we have now.
The choice of these the characters that come into play with the three main characters, this beggar woman and this, it was all written.
Some were written, some were during the place, and you find the people and you see the context, and then you involve the situation. And in many instances, were written, but based upon what we have already seen in the first time that we went just to scout. So it was a combination of both. Trying always not just to be for the sake of being folkloric, you know, just for the sake. It was always for some thematic purpose of the scene. You know, that was, we were clear at that time about that every scene had to deal with death. So in this one, even if, by the way, she's talking about the death of her aunt and how it affects her, you know? And so we wanted to involve all people, you know? And so that was the process of how everything, you know, had to work in a way. One thing is the reflection of the other, or the projection of the other.
At the same time, it's unbelievable that this film could be shot in America. I mean, the sex scenes and so on, this triangular story and so on. I mean,
The explicitness of the sex.
It was impossible.
Well, even
to do it in America.
Just to find the actors to do it with. I tell you, because in Great Expectations, the actors explicitly said, we would do that in an independent movie, but not in a Hollywood movie. And I was like, how do you define Hollywood, you know, independent or not independent? So there's a lot of culture around what you do and you don't do, you know? Well, here we had absolute freedom. And one more time, at this point, Alejandro had already walked into my and Guillermo's life right before we release, 1 year before, or yeah, because first it started Guillermo, that he was trying to find himself, and he did Devil's Backbone, and then I was with Itumama también, I was writing with Carlos, but conferring with Guillermo. So much that the resolution, the end, I was like, okay, I have all of this, but I don't find the point of connect. How is this going to be relevant thematic? He just says, man, these two have to kiss each other. They have to have sex with each other. It's what's going to happen. And then it's going to be all the shame, stupid shame, because of all the baggage, cultural baggage that they have, you know? But it was Guillermo, I remember that afternoon, that you said, hey, and he was like, oh. So. And. So yeah, and Alejandro is that I was reading the script, I was already prepping, and Alejandro, that I have met a couple of years ago, that he showed me a short film. He went to LA to show. He said, I'm a fan, can I go? And I said, sure. And I have heard of him from other people, from Chivo. So he came. Chivo says, I worked with a guy the first day of shoot. He went to work with a guy, says, never shot anything that Alejandro González Iñárritu would try to look in the camera. Through the place where you hold the tripod, he will try to put his eye there and stop. Chivo describes that he was just like trying to, and Chivo says, by the second day, he knew more than anybody in the set, more than me, more than anything, you know? So he was telling me so much about Alejandro. He contacted me, he showed me the short. I saw the short, he says, Alejandro, this is horrible, you know? And we talk about it. And then he went back and he started writing and stuff. And then he came up with a screenplay of Amores Perros, and I was like, whoa! And he read it, and blah, blah, blah. And at that period, he had completed his first cut. So I watched the cut. I'm in awe. You know, it was really shocked. And from that short, I was not expecting that. This is as if you're watching Great Expectations to Mama Tambien, and then you see Children of Men. You know, it's like, and I call Guillermo and say, Guillermo, do you mind if you see this thing? And this bastard, instead of saying, Alejandro, come up, he arrives to Alejandro's house, not knowing Alejandro. They didn't know each other. With his bag, because he was going to stay there 2 days or 3 days, I don't know how many days you stay. And he sat there, and now there's a big conflict. According to Guillermo, how many minutes you got?
Conflict. I have a VHS. It's 21 minutes longer before we fucked it up.
Okay, according to Guillermo, he got 21 movies out of Amores Perros. According to Alejandro, it's 3 or 4?
No, Alejandro said 7 and then 3.
Yeah. But anyway, so that was the beginning of a collaboration. So he released Amores Perros, and he became part of also a bouncing board for this film.
Now, we go to Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Almost everybody thinks it's the best Harry Potter. It's more somber, it's more... there is more anguish and so on, and you deal again with children. So I chose another excerpt which gives perhaps this kind of gothic dimension to the story. But how did you come to direct it? Is it true that J.K. Rowling liked The Little Princess, and she asked you to do? She approved your name?
Yeah, I mean, I have to preempt that as saying that. Again, it was not by my design. When I was finishing, Ito Mama Tambien, we have just started going to Venice, I think. I started writing a new screenplay that was supposed to be my next film.
About the Mexican rebellion, the students.
No,
in
well,
Mexico.
That I was, but seriously, I was writing one screenplay that I wrote the whole screenplay. It was ready in 2000. I delivered the screen because it was for a studio. And it was ready in the January of 2001. And they refused to do it. And I might find myself one more time, you know, like saying, wow, now what am I going to do? With the resources I have, I cannot survive to put together another Mexican movie. You know, I need to, yeah, and I was trying to actually to put together something or to do whatever when that offer came that it was so funny that they came to me for Harry Potter. And Alejandro, Gael and Diego, they just were making fun of me all the time about me going to do Harry Potter. And I have to say, I joined the joke. I didn't know anything about Harry Potter. You know, I have gone to see the premiere, not the premiere, but the first one, and I was not impressed, and I just, so, and they offer and says, okay, yes, send it, but I had it there. And then I'm talking with Guillermo, and I said, what's happening? No, this other project that fell apart, the name of that screenplay was Children of Men, okay? So I'm talking with Guillermo, and said, no, they don't want to do children. They will never want to do this. It's too obscure for them, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Says, I don't know what to do now. And he says, have they offered you something? No, just crap. They offered me Harry Potter. And this Guillermo says, what are you talking about? He says, yeah, they offered me Harry Potter. And man, how am I going to do Harry Potter? You know, it's Harry Potter. Have you read the books? And says, I said, I saw the film, I'm not in, it's not my thing. And then he said, have you read the books? No, I have not read the books. And then he got so pissed off at me. Sorry for the words, he said, you fucking arrogant bastard. Go right now, buy the fucking books and call me back.
All right.
And then.
Now you are in Guillermo del Toro's territory. So this surrealistic dimension or fantastic dimension, and something that you obviously are very much aware of in this film. It has an extra dimension compared to the first two films.
Well, I approach it in a realistic way. You know, not naturalistic, but realistic. It was same as Little Princess. I don't know why they offered me this movie, because I was coming out of an explicit sex film. Yeah, and people complained like, why are you going to give to you? And I understand why. I know then later I learned that J.K. liked a lot Little Princess. And when I talked with J.K., what I was fascinated, and that's something I discussed with Guillermo about the Harry Potter universe, is that there's a contemporary reference and as a social reference to most of this stuff. So I decided to approach it like that, you know, and I was approaching everything in a more kind of realistic way. I mean, if there's a character that's going to become the werewolf, is actually yes, but this is the guy who ultimately has a tendency, has an addiction. You know, with the actors, I approach with him as you're an addict. You know, you're a very good, nice person, except when you fall into your habits or you're a danger to the children, you know? And that was the approach. And before the monster was the character, that I think is something I learned from this man, you know? And that was the approach, basically. And something fun was working with the children. I enjoy working with children. I did in doing
TV.
You
had them in Great Expectations. You had them
in A Little Princess and Great Expectations, the whole first part. Doing on the TV shows that I did one or two with children. And I feel very comfortable working with them. I find it so easy to work with them, you know, because they offer miracles immediately, you know. And the approach here was the film was mostly cast. I completed the cast of, you know, extra characters and stuff, but I was blessed to work with these kids. I was very lucky because the story takes place when they are 13. It's a turning point, you know, becoming teenagers. And they were 13, becoming teenagers. They started taking seriously themselves about acting, as opposed to just being children playing and being called to do the shot. And that was interesting, like, Daniel Radcliffe working with Gary Oldman. Daniel Radcliffe, he was 13 and he was so earnest and so intense like Gary, you know. So it was fantastic, it was so great.
Is it true that you asked David Radcliffe to look at Les 400 coups by Truffaut?
Yes, of course, it's the first thing that I asked him to do.
you do that sometimes with your actors, show them a film? Or?
Yes, a film, a book, some music or something
that they get the tune that you want.
Yeah, so they get it. It's a shortcut. You show the 400 blows, and you get it. And if you're 13, you see these princes, I get it. You know, but also I wanted to see the naturalism of it. You know, of the performances the actor, Jean-Pierre Léaud, just transparency, you know, and they were very excited about that, you know, the way that I worked with them was they were very earnest about doing their auto. You know, I asked them to do the first thing. They was at home. We were doing I wanted their autobiography written by them, but from the standpoint of their character. You know, so it was, and they were really good at doing all that stuff. It was so much fun.
Now we go to the next film. Oh, yeah. I know that you admire Stanley Kubrick. It's very interesting because you did first the dystopia and then the Space Odyssey. So he did first the Space Odyssey and after the dystopia. He did 2001 and after Clockwork Orange. And you did Children of Men and then Gravity.
I wish I'd done the other ones.
Yes. But it's interesting because you have two examples of the same type of genre. One, the dystopia about the society of England which is even more of present today than when you did Children of Men, because it's really about the refusal of migrants. The state is chasing migrants and doesn't want to accept them and so on. You have that every day on the newspaper today, much more than 10 years ago. And at the same time, after that, we will talk, of course, about gravity. So we'll see. That's another... I think your work is extremely eclectic. You do very different things. This is really an action scene, which I've chosen from The Children of Men, where it's a society where the last person born was 18 years ago. Nobody is born anymore, except a black woman who is having a child. She's bearing a child. And, of course, the people who have a child are being chased and killed and so on. So we see, and she's under the protection of a man, Clive Owen, and he finds himself in this incredible, like the Middle East situation today, like Beirut or like Damas or whatever. So we go back again to your sequence shot. That was incredible and very much, as I said earlier, very much about today.
Well,
than even at the time.
I have to go because when I start writing this in October 2011, and the reason is that I was Y Tu Mamá También got a premiere in Venice. We flew from Venice to Toronto Film Festival. We had our premiere that was amazing, and the next day was September 11, and we were stranded in Toronto. And I was with Gael and Diego, and it was a very strange time, very reflective, and I became very very intrigued about how this new century was going to shape. And it's when this material came to me. I didn't read the novel. I read a coverage and I said, okay, I want to do this. I have the story. If based upon that premise, I have that story. I was never interested in doing a science fiction movie. Actually, my approach, and for me, is not a science fiction movie.
So it's a dystopia.
Probably, yes, it's a dystopia, definitely. But everything that the in many ways, I'm very lucky that the movie didn't happen after Y Tu Mamá También, because during the time I was doing Harry Potter, that shooting Harry Potter's is so long, and you're working with children and stuff, that part of the is not like an intense schedule when you're doing like a smaller movie. You know, you have more time in between things. So it gave me time to start doing a very in-depth research in what I was calling is the themes that are shaping this century. And I was reading and getting in touch with amazing, intelligent people and coming to the same conclusions, all of them. So the film starts to be that, and I was more interested in many ways. The thriller, yes, I always like genre and I like the thriller aspect of it, but I was interested through that to be just like the sheep's skin, the skin of a sheep, to be telling the story, this almost essay that was going to be in the background. And it became a film as something was very intensely researched and in which the reference were reference of something else, you know, all, everything thematic, from music, from the artwork that you see, everything thematically had to come together.
But there is this documentary-like style that is very, of course,
yes,
characteristic of that sequence, for instance.
Well, one thing that early on was Battle of Algiers, that I remember...
Pontecorvo.
I wanted Clive... Actually, that's the reason Clive... Because the script was kind of obscure in many ways, character-wise and stuff. I was more intrigued in the background, in the context, in the society around. And And Clive says, well, I want to work with you, the script. And then I says, can you please watch Battle of Algiers? And he says, I completely get it. You know, I completely get it. And with Chivo talking, because when I'm, and another amazing thing of going back to write is that by writing, you are just, you're writing not words, you're describing your shots. So most of these, the shots that I are already suggested in the on the page. And I was talking to Chivo about that stuff. I says, yes, it's like the difference that I wanted to be real time. You know, approach it as just the same way that we approach it to Mamá También, about finding a moment of truthfulness and being there just to register that moment of truthfulness with in which foreground and background are the same thing. And therefore, the long, long, long shots. We tried at some point Steadicam, and we realized it was too polished for this. So we decided to go handheld, but it was very clear it was going to be mostly a long, you know, long, continuous shots, not because of an Olympic of continuous shots, you know? It was just, and because when the shots lost its meaning, we would cut, you know, as opposed to force the shot, in other words. So, and that was that was the approach. But what it was important, again, is what was in front of the camera.
But the contribution of George Richmond, who held the camera, was very
amazing.
Important.
Yes. No, amazing, because, I mean, Chivo frankly said, I cannot operate this thing. You know, it's running backwards through debris. And for a long time, I mean, you have to have a very strong back because those shots are very long. Even poor Clive Owen, he was barefoot running through all this debris, poor thing. He should have not seen Battle of Algiers, maybe.
Where did you find the locations?
This was, everything was shot around London. But the whole idea was to do reference of, everything is visually based of reference of photographs, news, reference from the last 10 years of conflict in the world. So we wanted London to become a microcosm of the world, as opposed to the first world kind of living in a different geography than the zones of conflict. Now everything is inside there, and that was part of the thing. And so everything is around London.
So time is running, but we see the last excerpt, Gravity, which in a way is pure cinema in the sense that there is almost no plot, really. It's almost a linear story with no episodes and so on. It's just this woman lost in space with a contact with Kowalski. Is it Kowalski from Streetcar Named Desire?
No.
It's not Stanley
from,
Kowalski?
Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. He knows.
Is where?
The TV series, there was a character they were always killing.
Oh, yes, because there is also Marlon Brando.
No, of course, but that's too highbrow.
All right, so we see, to end this conversation, we see an excerpt from Gravity with Sandra Bullock.
Perfect.
No, I chose this sequence because of the opposition between the first part and the second part. That is the chromatic experience, for the blues totally dominate the first part, the yellows, the fire in the second part. So can you talk about this, you know, chromatic visualization of the film?
With Chivo we work very, you know, it was very clear early on that it was going to be a digital project. And we start working like crazy to find the actual references. So in the exteriors, actually, we discovered that it is a light that doesn't exist in planet Earth. So it was Chivo's task to try to replicate that stuff. And in here, we have endless references of the space station. So we knew that we wanted this moment of quietness. We have come out of a more warm moment that she's in a fetal position, and it's a bit warmer moment. We wanted, it's a relaxed moment, but we had to go back into into the Jeopardy. So it was the color was it was not so comforting. You know, it was enough to not. You know, it was is this cool thing through the station that also is very organic to the real lighting in the station. By the way, the station is a replica of the real one. And she will have the lights reference and all of that stuff. And the second part, obviously, is the fire that is coming in the moment in which this woman is still adrift in a way that she has not. She just adrift and not even trying to row, you know. And in other words, she's not being proactive about trying to save her ass. She's been just escaping. And it's going to be a transition in which she's going to be forced to do so. This is a film that, not unlike others that I've done, this is not a movie that I had in my head for many years. After Children of Men, I had this small project that I was going to do because I felt that I have the security.
Daniel Auteuil and Charlotte Gainsbourg?
That one. Yes. That one. And because I thought, okay, now is my moment to go back to do my, you know, I already did Harry Potter, whatever, Children that I wanted to do as my film, but I had certain response, so I feel also thematically ready to do my own stuff. And I have the money to survive while I go through the experience, and then life happens, and life doesn't, you know, so I find myself that life does their things, and my life turned upside down, and I find myself with an amazing need to raise money to survive. But I had the wisdom and also the security to say, it's going to be on my terms. So pretty much the whole thing of Gravity with my son was when he had written the other script as well. We put together the story maybe in 9 hours. And we were, because it was this thing of, I'm going to do the film that they would, I hope that they will buy, but that I really want to do. And it was Jonas who said, look, he loves, for instance, Dead Man Escapes. And I said, why don't we try to, you know, it's impossible, we don't try to do Dead Man Escape, but.
Un condamné à mort s'est échappé. Mm-hmm. It's a French title.
Ah, okay.
For the audience.
Sorry. Yeah, Bresson's film. I said, yes. And that was, curiously, that was the point of the departure of a conversation, of how you create. Because I find that Bresson has created one of the most suspenseful scenes in cinema with that scape, you know? And obviously is a film that is about freedom, but in a freedom as a higher concept, you know, and that was the point of departure for conversations. So first draft, it was only one character, didn't have a name. It was the woman, and there was not one single line of dialogue, and that was a tough sell.
But you know, I started this conversation by mentioning that you did some philosophy studies, and it's interesting because this film is philosophical. It's about rebirth. It's about a new life. This woman has lost a child, and she rediscovers herself. And all the great science fiction films or books are all philosophical. It's a genre that is fundamentally philosophical.
Well, this is not science fiction in the sense that is nothing. Everything that we show exists. We just heighten the in many ways. Is not, strictly speaking, not science fiction because it's everything out there is factual. We just heighten, it's more like a thriller or something, but I understand that because you have space, there's a reference of science fiction. But yeah, I'm glad you got those things because part of the thing, and I guess that has been like the search is to how to tell, to convey themes without being explicit. You know, without being, without doing expositions about them. You know, so how to talk about this thing of rebirth without talking about it? How to talk about, you know, how to express it, how to feel it, you know, how to experience it. And yeah, that was, and that is what it's been like I'm trying to do in the, particularly in the, ever since I have a more mature conscience about cinema.
Thank you very much, Alfonso
Cuarón. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Michelle. Gracias. Thank you. Ven acá. Ven acá. Ven acá. Ah, tienes la mía mala. Ok. Ay, cabrón. Perdón, ahorita ya te. Acá.
Me meto, cabrón.